The film Rockstar opens this coming weekend. It stars Mark Wahlberg as a young rock musician who loves the heavy metal band Steel Dragon. His own band is a copycat version of that group, and he models his sound and style after the lead singer. His big break comes when the lead singer of Steel Dragon leaves to pursue a solo career. The band then taps Wahlberg's character to replace him. It's every young rocker's dream, and it happens to be based on a true story. Andrew Revkin is an environmental reporter for the New York Times and author of The Burning Season, the story of a slain rainforest activist. In 1997, he stepped outside his normal beat to write a piece that evolved into Rockstar. And he joins us now from our New York bureau. Andrew Revkin, welcome.
It's nice to be here.
So tell us a little bit from the start, more or less. Who is the real-life rocker, and what was the band that he joined?
I was channel surfing one night and passed either VH1 or MTV and caught one of these little 30-second blurbs about a seemingly inconsequential bit of rock news that Judas Priest, the fabled heavy metal band, was broken up, but they were reforming, and they had chosen as their new lead singer a guy from an Akron, Ohio copycat band or tribute band named Tim Owens, although they now called him Ripper Owens. And it just kind of stuck in my head. I just thought it was like hearing a joke or something on your morning commute and passing it along to other people. I kept repeating it. You hear this guy from a copycat band that ended up replacing the guy he spent his whole life imitating? And then I pitched it as a story to our arts pages, which normally cover things like opera and Balinese gamelan. And
Judas Priest is not among the items you usually find in the arts section in the New York Times.
No, but they kind of got captivated by the sort of once upon a time in America aspects of this, you know.
So who is this guy, Ripper Owens, and how did he come to the attention of Judas Priest?
Well, I started in on my research on him back then, and he was a kid who just worshipped Judas Priest from the first time his older brother brought home an album. His mom told me that his bedroom was papered with Judas Priest posters and album covers. And he started singing. He was really talented. He sang in the choir. And he started singing in bands, copying Judas Priest's act, kind of copying every move, the classic kind of tribute band style where you actually dress the part, you emulate every aspect of your metal god that you worship. And he got pretty good at it. He got so good that he replaced the lead singer in Ohio's leading heavy metal Judas Priest tribute band, a guy named Jim Williams in U.S. Metal, and he now was kind of ascending the tribute band ladder and doing okay. And in the daytime, though, he always kept his day job, which was variously working as a clerk at a legal firm and then office supplies salesman.
And how did he come to the attention of the folks at Judas Priest, which, by the way, is a heavy metal band? They're an English band, right?
Right, they're from the Midlands, real sort of what they call black country British, the iron mongering part of Britain where that clanging sound in the factories probably gave birth to the metal sound. What happened was there were groupies who were not only groupies of the real band, but they were groupies of the tribute band. And as they toured Middle America there, sort of the Midwest, there were a couple of women in Erie, Pennsylvania, who saw them at a club one night and videotaped them. And one of these women was having somewhat of a relationship at the time with the drummer from the real band, and they were pretty much dormant. And they were starting to think about reforming, and she gave him this tape that she had made in this club, not thinking much about it at the time, said, "You got to check this guy out." And the tape made its way back to England, to Wales, where they were actually doing tryouts of all kinds of singers. One of the guys in the band, when I interviewed him, told me they had pretty much canvassed the whole world, Eskimos, Russians, women, men, and hadn't found anything. And they saw this videotape, and they couldn't believe it. They called Tim the next day, said, "Can you be in England tomorrow? We have a ticket waiting for you."
Hello?
Chris?
Yeah?
Is that Chris Cole?
Who is this?
This is Kurt Caddy.
Ricky, you know your English accent is almost as lame as your guitar playing?
Well, I can't hear much about the accent. What do you suggest to do about my playing?
All right, if this is Kurt Caddy, then what'd you used to call your third wife?
A third wife? We don't have to talk about that old slag, do we? All right, I called her Sugar Bum.
Oh, my God, this is unbelievable. Hey, I was so sorry to hear about your dog, man.
Oh, Pookie?
Yeah, it was horrible. I mean, I sent flowers and a card and stuff, but I didn't get a response. But, you know, I probably figured you guys are so busy anyway. It wasn't
Look,
a big
deal.
Look, can
we get past all this is
your life crap and on to more important things? There's a ticket waiting for you at the airport for a flight tomorrow.
Are you serious?
Of course I'm serious. Now, look, you tell no one about this, okay?
Yes, sir.
Good man. Well, I'll see you tomorrow.
Okay. Bye.
He took the flight, and he told me he described this wondrous process of walking into this mansion, walking down this vast dining room and seeing these people he had only seen on his bedroom wall or at a distance in a concert hall, and now he was among them. And he sang a tune, a tryout, and they loved it. They said, you got the job.
They, in fact, didn't even let him get through the tune that he sang before they decided he was the one.
That's right. It was a tune that he was kind of famous for back in Akron, for holding some notes so long that you'd think his lungs would blow up. And I guess he did a good job. Whiskey woman, don't you know that you are driving me insane? Deliver your gifts to the wheelchair. Gets right through my brain.
So you wrote all this up, and your editors put it into the art section of the New York Times?
Yeah, this is the only time in my career, 20 years in journalism, when an editor told me to write more. Connie Rosenblum, who was editing the section at the time, just loved it. She fell in love with the fairy tale aspect of it, and she asked me to write twice as much.
Wow.
And I happily did, a rare treat for a writer. And
yeah,
the next day, the day after it came out, that's when Hollywood called, and they got a screenplay going. And it quickly kind of morphed into this sort of Hollywood version of a story. And left reality far behind.
Oh, really? So it's still based on the life of Tim Owen?
Well, in the formal language of Hollywood, it's inspired by. It is a work of fiction, the studio has said straight out. And indeed, the band went from sort of Leather and Studs heavy metal to more Van Halen-ish pop metal, LA-style metal. They changed the dates and the names. But the heart of the story is clearly the same. And Judas Priest had told them early on that they didn't want to kind of get involved formally, and that's why they had to morph it. But the other reason they had to change it was Tim Owen's real life has only had its first and second acts. He's had the climb, he's gotten to the point, and his real life hasn't had the rest of the arc yet, so we'll see where that goes. But they made up a kind of a fun what-if ending where indeed he goes off. This is in the mid-80s, and he goes off and becomes a metal star and then gets kind of disenchanted with this and realizes he wants to be himself, not a copy of someone else, and invents grunge rock.
Ah, Hollywood.
Yeah.
Tell me about the music that's in the film.
One of the neat aspects of this thing to me, watching this come together the last 4 years, was how they had to kind of invent a hit band, a metal machine, and they had to create a sound to do that catches your ear and takes you on that ride that only hard rock can do. And they did. They brought out of semi-retirement a producer, Tom Werman. He now runs a bed and breakfast near Williamstown, Massachusetts, but he used to produce all the records of Motley Crue and all the bands of the 80s, and they brought him out and said, we need to make a new one, and they put together a bunch of songwriters and invented the repertoire of this fictional band, Steel Dragon, and I think they did a pretty amazing job. And of course, they had this quite a roster of rock musicians to draw on. The movie is peppered with real rock artists, some of whom are just amazing.
Hmm. Can you give me some examples?
Well, there's Zakk Wylde, W-Y-L-D-E. He was Ozzy Osbourne's guitarist for a long time. He's an amazing musician. He's kind of the Paganini of heavy metal. His fingers do impossible things. He just soars, and you can't believe what he's able to do. And Zach's own life kind of mirrors Tim's life, because he was just a player in a Jersey band, and he got plucked from obscurity to be Ozzy's sideman, and now to be a movie star.
Now, Andrew, I understand that you had some rock dreams of your own and tried writing some music for this film.
Well, you know, there's more than one everything that's on the side, a musician or aspiring songwriter. And I kind of grew up with folk and bluegrass, but I have a few guitars and I have some electric guitars. And I thought, okay, here's my chance. I kind of got the brass ring with the movie, and maybe I'll get the gold ring. Maybe I'll get a soundtrack cut and pay off the mortgage. And so I went into a studio with a friend who's a touring rock musician, and we put together a couple songs, and I figured, okay, maybe they'll listen to them. You know, I'm the writer after all, right? They diplomatically preferred the work of Sammy Hagar from Van Halen and Marilyn Manson's bass player to the work of an environment writer from the New York Times. I can't fault them.
Keep your day job, kid, in other words.
Exactly.
Well, let me just ask now, have you seen the film? Did it turn out the way you thought, or are you happy with it?
Yeah, I've seen it, and I watched the script evolve. The script evolved through the years, and they didn't make fun of these guys, which is pretty easy to do. You know, it's not Spinal Tap. It's it conveys effectively the worshipful relationship between the Tim Owens of the world and the bands that they love. And it's sort of like that magic transformation when Alice goes through the looking glass, or when it just happens once in a while when someone gets to levitate to the realm of the gods, in this case, the metal gods, and become the thing that you spend your life worshiping. And it gets that across. So it's a fun romp through a world that I wouldn't normally explore.
Well, good. Andrew Revkin, thank you very much.
Thank you.